All right, we are back. And a topic that's worthy of discussion here is, you know, the potential backlash resulting from Donald Trump appointing three stooges to the Supreme Court, who then overturned Roe v. Wade on the most asinine legal reasoning, if that's what you want to call it, and have thrown reproductive rights, you know, just tossed them to the wind. Anyway, with abortion being driven back into the shadows, you know, of the back alley day, there's been a great deal of pushback from women in particular. The Economist weighed in on this at some length in its June 1st issue, and I think we should quote a bit from it. Noted in their editorial, about 10,000 women eligible to vote this November were born before women won the right to vote. In the centuries since then, American women have steadily accumulated rights. In the 1960s, the contraceptive pill let women choose how many children they had. In the 1970s, no-fault divorce laws and Roe v. Wade gave women more choices that had been denied to their mothers. The process seemed irreversible and was often taken for granted. Then, 2 years ago, the Supreme Court overturned Roe, throwing the question of allowing or disallowing abortion back to the states. Turns out that rights can be taken away, too. One-third of American women, aged 15 to 49, now live in states where abortion is either illegal or impossibly restricted. Some states have passed statutes so severe and vaguely drafted that doctors fear they may be forced to choose between saving a patient's life, in the case of a dangerous miscarriage or complicated pregnancy, and breaking the law. Hobbs, the Supreme Court decision that overturned Roe, has been a goal for the anti-abortion movement. Surprisingly, the number of abortions has risen slightly since it was announced. Although some states promptly banned the procedure, others made it easier to obtain. Also, federal drug regulators have allowed abortifacient pills to be prescribed by mail, giving millions of women, including some in anti-abortion states, easier access to early-term abortions than they had before. However, for millions of other women, getting a legal termination has become much harder. The result of the court's decision, then, has been to assign people more or less choice depending on where they live. Outrage has given rise to a grassroots political movement that involves more Americans than any such uprising since Black Lives Matter in 2020 or the Tea Party more than a decade ago. However, it is better organized and has clearer goals. Its foot soldiers carry clipboards. Tens of thousands of volunteers have gathered millions of signatures to put abortion rules to state referendums. The movement has already had success in some surprising states like Ohio and Kansas. As many as 16 states could hold abortion referendums on the same day Americans will pick their next president. But only 24 of the 50 states allow citizen-led ballot initiatives. So the patchwork of state campaigns is a poor substitute for a federal law. The Economist asks, could the backlash against Dobbs keep the man whose judicial appointments made it possible, Donald Trump, out of the White House? Maybe, they speculate. Few voters are enthusiastic about Mr. Biden. A mass movement in support of a goal his party shares ought to boost the turnout of Democrats. Abortion referendums in Arizona and Nevada, two swing states, could spur marginal centrist and left-leaning voters to make their way to the polling station. It should be kept in mind, as pointed out by Jennifer Rubin writing in the Washington Post, that the GOP's war on women won't stop at banning abortion. They're after contraception also. That's the message Senate Republicans sent a few weeks back by blocking a Democratic bill to enshrine a federal right to birth control access. Republicans denied any plans to snatch away contraception, just as they denied that right-wing Supreme Court justices were out to gut Roe v. Wade, and dismissed the bill as an election year stunt intended to whip up panic among women voters. But, notes Rubin, voters have a good reason to worry. GOP state lawmakers in Oklahoma have advanced legislation to ban intrauterine devices, claiming falsely that they're abortifacients. And some GOP politicians oppose morning after pills on similar grounds. Then there's Donald Trump, who recently let slip that he was looking at contraceptive restrictions. Anyway, one can hope that this movement of pushing back against abortion restrictions will really continue to gain traction and that women will come out and fight for what rights they once had. Polls show that in America, 74% of women say abortion should be legal in all or most cases. We'll see how that translates into political action. Now, some months ago, we quoted extensively from an editorial piece in New Scientist, well, a columnist, I guess you more properly would say, Annalee Newitz. And in the June 15th issue, she took a perspective that just kind of slapped me upside the head. Newitz's writing is so insightful, I think I'm going to quote extensively from her essay. It has been nearly a decade since hackers dumped huge amounts of personal data from Ashley Madison, the infamous dating site, which back in 2015 catered mostly to men who wanted to cheat on their wives. Now, that story is back in the media, partly because of a recent Netflix documentary about it. Newitz says you can see me in that series, a nerdy talking head in clips from various TV news shows from 2015, because I was one of the journalists breaking the story. But neither the Netflix series nor the handful of other documentaries still in the works get at what was truly revolutionary and chilling about the Ashley Madison affair. Generally, the media focused on the mainly men whose names and desires were taken from the company's subscribers' database and shared with the world. But that isn't a new story. People have been trying to have affairs with strangers for thousands of years. Ashley Madison was never really about that. Avid Life Media, its parent company, wasn't in the business of sex. It was in the business of bots. Its site became a prototype for what social media platforms such as Facebook are becoming. Places so packed with AI-generated nonsense that they feel like spam cages or information prisons, where the only messages that get through are auto-generated ads. After a rebrand, Ashley Madison is now owned by Ruby Life and bills itself as a spicy dating site for married people. But back then, it marketed itself as a social networking site for men seeking affairs with women. In late 2015, a group calling itself Impact Team got angry at the site and hacked onto its servers. The group grabbed a bunch of user data and code, then posted it on Reddit, with the claim that 95% of the people on the site were married men. I was intrigued. How could all those men be having affairs if there were virtually no women on the site? With the help of two hackers and a database expert, I decided to find out. What I discovered was a bizarre scam, though it was far more like Westworld than the U.S. reality show Cheaters. The company had systematically created an army of fake women, mostly very simple chatbots called engagers, who would flirt with men to lure them into paying for a subscription to the site. As I wrote in 2015, it's like a science fictional future where every woman on Earth is dead and somehow a Dilbert-like engineer has replaced them with badly designed robots. As we pored over the code, we found that although there were a few women on the site, more than 11 million interactions logged in the database were between human men and female bots, and the men had to pay for every single message they sent. For most of their millions of users, Ashley Madison affairs were entirely a fantasy built out of threadbare chatbot pickup lines like, "How are you?" and "What's up?" There were real women behind the curtain, though. We found company emails in the data dump and discovered that Avid Life Media was also paying a small number of workers to generate fake profiles for more than 70,000 engager bots. One of these workers sued the company in 2013. Notes Newlitz, at the time I was shocked by the sheer number of fake women. I wrote, instead of looking at Ashley Madison as a dating site, I think it's more accurate to call it an anti-community, a hugely popular social site where it's impossible to be social because the men can't talk to each other. Most of the women are fake, and the only interaction available is with credit card payments. 9 years later, this could describe any number of social media sites that have become swamped with bots and AI-generated absurdity, and charge you for the privilege of interacting with the techno-phantoms. Currently, Facebook is trying to figure out how to deal with millions of fake images created by AI, while Google's AI bot Overview is telling users to glue cheese to pizza. The problem is, human beings are interacting with these AI images and suggestions, in some cases imagining they're engaging with real people. It's like the whole world has become the Ashley Madison of 2015, and the more we want to talk to each other about it, the less likely we are to find a human to talk to. Another piece from New Scientist, which deals with this, what's described as disastrous new AI research tool, e.g. AI overviews. Well, there's some surprises here. To quote from the analysis in the magazine, Google is attempting to transform the way we search the internet, but it isn't going very well. Rather than simply providing links to other websites, Google's new AI overviews tools attempts to summarize information with mixed success. Reports of people being told to glue cheese to pizza or dine on rocks have gone viral in recent weeks. The question now is whether Google can fix this problem or be forced to roll back the AI tool, which is currently available only to people in the U.S. Google says it has already made improvements, but experts are divided over whether the generative AI technology powering the tool has fundamental problems that can't be solved. Piece quotes Noura Al-Mohabbayed at Durham University, UK, saying that large language models used by Google and others will always be flawed when it comes to providing factual information because of their statistical nature after being trained on vast amounts of text from the internet. They piece together an output based on which word is most likely to fit next. In the case of Google's AI suggesting using glue on pizzas, the origin was traced back to a decade-old Reddit post. And yes, the question is being raised of, you know, if you're just scooping up data everywhere, but you're not really assessing the accuracy of it, well, bad things are going to happen, and apparently are already happening. And moving on to the Week magazine, which usually has excellent briefing sections in every issue, which does a very succinct and generally accurate summary of this or that or the other. The June 21st edition of the magazine. We've been scratching our head over this on this program for some years. The briefing section concerns itself with the supposed problem of, quote, the great baby bust, noting that the fertility rate is falling sharply in the U.S. and elsewhere, a trend with major economic and societal consequences, which I don't doubt, but the idea that this is a bad idea, which I hear from economist types, is crazy. But there's some startling numbers being presented in this briefing. To the question, where are birth rates dropping? The answer comes back almost everywhere. 2/3 of the world's population now lives in countries where the birth rate has dropped below 2.1 babies per woman, the number needed to keep the population constant. Best, the birth rate stands at 1.62, down from 2.12 in 2007, and the population is expected to dip after peaking at 370 million in 2080. Does this give you confidence? They're looking at 2080, seeing a peak then. And of course, there is the matter of immigration increasing the population numbers. But I digress. In Europe, the average birth rate is now 1.5. In East Asia, 1.2. In Latin America, 1.9. It's noted that this trend has surprised demographers, many of whom have spent years worrying about an overcrowded planet. As recently as 2017, the UN was predicting the world's population, about 8 billion today, would climb to 11 billion by 2100. And I'm here to tell you, we're never going to make that. The current predictions are that the population might peak at about 9.5 billion in 2061. By the way, in the year 2022, according to the piece, the Chinese population dropped 850,000 people, which leaves it at only 1.41 billion. It's reported that although the Chinese authorities scrapped the one-child policy back in 2015, the birth rate has not ticked up because grown-up single children who enjoyed their parents' undivided attention want their offspring to have a similar upbringing. The question, can birth rates be boosted? Ouch. The reply is, governments are trying, but nothing has been particularly effective. Japan has experimented with child care subsidies and stipends since the 90s. Its fertility rate climbed from 1.26 in 2005 to 1.45 in 2015, then sank back to 1.26 again in 2022. If you look at the world and what's happening and the effect of more humans on the world's resources and more CO2 from driving more cars, using more energy, you just have to shake your head at the notion that what we have to do is boost our population. And the other briefing section I want to quote from about things that shouldn't be increased has to do with the national debt. In the May 24th edition, the magazine took a look at, well, starting with, what does the U.S. owe? In case you're keeping score, our national debt stands at $35 trillion, which is about $100,000 per person. And the debt has climbed sharply over the past two decades. In 2000, we owed $5.6 trillion. But with both Democratic and Republican administrations running budget deficits, meaning they spend more than they took in, this year the deficit is on track to hit $1.5 trillion, about 5% of the gross domestic product. Because interest rates were low and expected to stay low, many officials and experts thought the cost of servicing that debt would remain manageable. But the pandemic and the return of high inflation changed that thinking. To curb inflation, the Federal Reserve hiked interest rates from close to zero in 2020 to above 5%. Partly as a result, the government is for the first time expected to spend more this year on interest payments on the debt, about $870 billion, than on defense, $850 billion. And I think this all comes down to the fact that people want to see government spending on things, but don't want to pay for it. And one thing seems clear. No matter which party gains primacy in the United States, nobody is going to raise taxes and cut spending. They're not going to do either one. Noted the briefing section, both candidates oppose making cuts to the big sources of federal spending, Social Security, Medicare, and defense. They quote Brian Riedel of the Conservative Manhattan Institute as saying, neither party is remotely serious about either spending cuts or tax increases. To the question of what happens if Congress does nothing, the final question asked, the answer provided was, under current policy, in the best case scenario, the U.S. has 20 years to take corrective action before the federal debt reaches an unsustainable level. That's according to the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton budget model. After that point, the analyst notes, no amount of future tax increase or spending cuts could avoid the government's defaulting on its debt. And frankly, I'm no economist, but I'm positive that won't be good. Speaking of economics, as I guess we were, the Washington Post's Catherine Rampell wrote about the riptide of economic ignorance going on in the country. She did so a few weeks back. She pondered the notion that Americans can't possibly be this ignorant about an economy, can they? A recent Harris Guardian poll showed that most Americans, 55%, think that the country is currently in a recession. The poll also found that roughly half, 49% of Americans, believe the unemployment rate is at a 50-year high, and the stock market is down since the beginning of the year. On all three issues, the truth is almost completely the opposite. The economy isn't shrinking. By virtually every benchmark, we're exceeding growth expectations and outperforming many other advanced economies. Unemployment hasn't been this low for this long since the Nixon administration, and the S&P 500 is up 10% this year. So why are the bad vibes still here? Commentators are quick to blame the media for the public's economic illiteracy, and noted Catherine Rampell, I agree. Journalists generally give more play to bad economic numbers than good ones. But if the media has a bad news bias, it's because our audiences do too. People are more likely to click, watch, listen to, and share content that induces outrage, a bias for negative news amplified by social media. The most useful thing you can do to help the general public grow more informed is to reward good news with your attention. And let's see if we can close this out with a piece that appeared in The Atlantic by Franklin Foer. Franklin Foer wrote, World Without Mind, The Existential Threat of Big Tech, some years back. Yours truly went to go see him speak over at Stanford. He's a pretty smart guy. And in his Atlantic piece, he weighed in on the industry that ate America. And I think this is worth some quoting from. Noted Franklin Foer, on March 18th, news broke that Donald Trump intended to restore the disgraced lobbyist Paul Manafort to the ranks of his campaign advisors. In any other moral universe, this would have been an unimaginable rehabilitation. Back in 2016, as revelations about Manafort's work on behalf of pro-Kremlin politicians in Ukraine began appearing in the press, even Trump considered him a figure so toxic that he forced him to resign as chair of his campaign. 2 years later, Manafort was locked up in federal prison on charges of tax evasion and money laundering, among other transgressions. His was one of the most precipitous falls in the history of Washington, D.C. But at this stage in that history, it's not remotely shocking to learn that the revolving door continues to turn. By the end of Trump's term, Manafort had already won a presidential pardon. His unwillingness to cooperate with Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation had earned him Trump's unstinting admiration. Trump tweeted, "Such respect for a brave man." Now it seemed that Manafort's loyalty would be rewarded with the lobbyist's most valuable tool, the perception of access, at an opportune moment. In early May, under growing media scrutiny for international consulting work that he'd reportedly been involved in after his pardon, Manafort said he would stick to the sidelines, playing a less visible role in supporting Trump. But if Trump wins the election, Manafort won't need 2024 campaign work officially on his resume to convince corporations and foreign regimes that he can bend any U.S. policy on their behalf, and that he and his ilk will be able to follow through on such pledges with unimpeded ease. A second Trump term would mark the culmination of the story chronicled by the brothers Luke and Brody Mullins, a pair of energetic reporters, in their absorbing new book, The Wolves of K Street, The Secret History of How Big Money Took Over Big Government. Noted Franklin for lobbying like Hollywood and Silicon Valley is a quintessentially American industry. This sector took root among the K Street corridor of gleaming glass and steel buildings in downtown D.C. during the 1970s. Although accurately capturing the scale of its growth is hard, a study by George Mason University's Stephen Fuller Institute reported that in 2016, the, quote, advocacy cluster, unquote, employed more than 117,000 workers in metropolitan Washington, which is more than the population of Manchester, New Hampshire. In theory, lobbying is a constitutionally protected form of redressing grievances. Businesses have every right to argue their case in front of government officials whose policies affect their industries. In practice, lobbying has become a pernicious force in the national life, courtesy of corporate America, which hugely outspends other constituencies, labor unions, consumers, and environmental groups, on an enterprise now dedicated to honing ever more sophisticated methods of shaping public opinion in service of its own ends. The forerunners of the modern lobbyists were Tommy the Corcoran, a member of President FDR's brain trust, and Clark Clifford, who ran President Harry Truman's poker games. Both men left jobs in government to become freelance fixers, working on behalf of corporate behemoths, the United Fruit Company, for example, and General Electric. Mystique was essential to their method. Corcoran kept his name out of the phone book and off his office door. If a company was bothered by a nettlesome bureaucrat or wanted help overthrowing a hostile Central American government, they were the men ready to pick up the phone and make it so. But Corcoran and Clifford were anomalous figures. In the late 1960s, only about 60 registered lobbyists were working in Washington. 60 then, 117,000 now. Then the piece stumbles into a guy named John Podesta. Anyway, I'm going to jump ship on this article. I recommend, dear listener, that you obtain a copy of it and read it. I'm sure it's online by now. Franklin Foer, The Industry That Ate America, subtitled The Long and Lurid History of Lobbying. And you know, I wonder, Mr. McMillan, how often we make a suggestion like that, that people actually take the time to look up an article. You know what? We asked last week for you to drop us a line, and we're going to do so again today. Drop us a line at info@radioparallax and talk to us about the show, where you are, how you listen in, what you like, what you don't like, what you think we should do more of, what you think we should do less of. Your doing so will allow us to create the new Radio Parallax app, which at the moment looks like a couple of guys we're going to hire in the Philippine Islands to answer your phone calls. And yes, we are kidding on that. There are no plans underfoot to create a Radio Parallax app. But hey, if you think we need one, you might include that in your correspondence with us, courtesy of info@radioparallax. All right, for our final item of the day, we're going to turn the clock back to something we talked about years ago, which was the Monty Hall problem. In the June 1st issue of New Scientist magazine, this was looked at again by mathematician Peter Rowlett. The mathematician took a look at how important it was to take care of judging the odds by factoring in all the data. And if you recall the program Let's Make a Deal, which I'm sure is probably still on, although Monty Hall has left the building. At the end of the show, there was a grand prize behind one of three doors. The contestant was asked to pick one of the doors. And after doing so, the host, I presume Monty Hall, would then open one of the two remaining doors to show some sort of goofball prize that was not what anybody wanted. Everybody watching the show assumed that the odds of picking the correct door was 1 out of 3, which was true. And everybody pretty much assumed that among the two doors that were left, there was a 2 out of 3 chance that one of those would have the prize. But the twist here is that, well, I guess you'd say there's a better way of thinking about it. You pick a door, your odds of 1 out of 3 are being right. The two remaining doors have an odds of 2/3 probability that that's where the prize is. But the host, knowing which door has the zonk or the nonsense prize, then shows you that one. The odds that the non-chosen doors contain the prize is two out of three. But you've now been shown which one it isn't, which means that the door that's left has a two out of three chances of being correct, and the one you picked has a one out of three chance of being correct. Therefore, if you were a Let's Make a Deal contestant, you would have doubled your odds of getting the correct prize by switching. But most people are conservative. They want to go with what it is they chose. And they figure the odds, you know, are still one out of three on the other door. Incorrectly. Don't have any way of knowing at this point, at the end of Let's Make a Deal, how many contestants switched, how many kept what they picked originally. And I sure would like to know the answer to that. And by God, if you do have the answer to that, be sure to send that to us via info@radioparallax.com. I have a sneaking suspicion that Let's Make a Deal saved a lot of prize money by people sticking with their original choice. That's just a guess on my part. Anyway, this program was produced by Edward McMillan, who historically has been very quick to switch on his original choices. You've been listening to Radio Parallax. I'm Douglas Everett. We've rounded up some of the news items we have not covered while on vacation and got us closer to where we need to be. And we hopefully will come to you again with a brand new show next week. Keep listening in, and please do write us, particularly if you're interested in starting that Edward McMillan fan club, which we know many of you are.